I know there's some people who would like to testify about clean water, but I'm not sure I'm willing to take on another subject now. I'd like to continue talking about the Parks and Trails and Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council issues. And I think we've discussed it. What we'll do at some point after we finish this portion of it, I think we're going to recess and then reconvene at about 6:30 and continue. And maybe at that point go to some staff can work together on some things that are the same in both bills, and maybe we can agree to those and start getting things to be written up, or maybe agree with some things that maybe if they aren't the same are non-contentious. So start again. Sorry for the interruption, Commissioner Landwehr.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Since I've lost my inertia here, I'm going to start in a new space and get off the ground again. Madam Chair, just by way of background, I have lived in the cities virtually my entire life, and I've been privileged to take advantage of what the cities have to offer in terms of recreation and open space. I've been chosen this field of natural resources, which I've been in for 30 years, so I certainly appreciate what we have in the Twin Cities, what we have in Minnesota, and the great need that we have, not just in the Twin Cities, but across Minnesota. And so, Madam Chair, to reiterate, in the metro area, the seven-county metro area, I just want people to understand that we do have a large presence here. Three state parks, one state recreation area. We have 79 public accesses. We've got two of the principal state trails in the state, the Bruce Line and the Gateway, both of which connect outside the metro area. Tremendous regional connections. We've got more than 1,000 miles of motorized trail, more than 100 miles of ski trails, 80-some fishing piers.
Again? No. Well, okay. I don't think. Go ahead, Commissioner.
Yeah. We have to wind up again then, Senator Cohen.
Lance is
back.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. And
they really need them. They'll come get them.
Right. And in addition, we offer programming, because one of the things that we know in our surveys of people is if we want to get people outdoors, it's not just a matter of providing them the facilities. More and more we have to teach people how to do things like camp and fish and so on. So the department has the Monaco program, the I Can Camp series, which are, again, funded by Legacy. Madam Chair, back to the story about Theodore Worth Park. I have spent some time collecting stories from 150 years ago about people coming to Minnesota looking for outdoor adventures. And, Madam Chair, I think some of the things that we see today that we recognize as urban parks, we need to remember that 100 years from today, some of the things that we look at as ex-urban open spaces are going to be our metro parks of the future. So we need to understand the seven-county metro area is growing out, and a lot of what we're doing outside the metro area is, in fact, the Theodore Worth Park, the Lake Calhoun of the future. And so we need to, again, reiterate that we are one Minnesota, and we need to look across Minnesota as a whole. We have humongous needs. We at the department. We are your recreation and asset provider. And we have tremendous needs beyond what you are seeing addressed in this bill, tens of millions of dollars of needs. So it is – I just want to remind people that when we hear about all the needs that the local and the metro and the regional park system have, yes, the state system has that as well. So there is – the primary point is there is way more need than there is money available, which, Madam Chair and members of the committee, leads me to my second point, and that is in the absence of a framework for spending – we have a bloodbath on an annual basis or biannual basis. And that is, Madam Chair, why you directed me last biennium to come up with a framework for allocating parks and trails funds. And so, Madam Chair, I have the statutory language that you tasked me with to develop a consensus recommendation for the allocation of parks and trails fund. As you know, this is a letter signed by myself, by Susan Haig from the Met Council, and by L. Liefert for the outstate areas, concurring on the 40-40-20 allocation. Madam Chair, members of the commission, their council, members of the committee, there is no correct number. There is no correct number. I can slice and dice this any way you want, and that is why you had a bloodbath in the House and the Senate last time, because there is no correct answer, and I can come up with any argument that will support one over the other. We pulled this group together because they are representative of the three legs of the stool in terms of providing outdoor recreation, and asked them to give us their best thought. And as Mr. Rice showed you, they went through a number of things. They had six meetings. It took six meetings to come to that number. It was not something that was thrown on the table that everybody agreed to. The exact same discussions that you're having here today about why it ought to be this or why it ought to be that are the same discussions they had over six meetings. There is nothing magic about that 40-40-20 recommendation, but that is what that committee believed was the most appropriate allocation based on the information they had for the next three biennia, by the way, to deal with this issue and get off the feeding frenzy that we have in the absence of having a framework. So, Madam Chair, I'm suggesting that there's not enough money, that whatever money that's out there, unless you have a framework for spending, you will have this continual battle about exactly how to do it. I think the 40-40-20 gives you the framework to work within, just like I believe when the legislature created the Lasard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council prior to the passage of the ballot. That was the intention, was to provide a framework. And if I could give a little historical context of my own, because prior to my position as a commissioner 2.5 years ago, I worked in the nonprofit sector for 9 years, first for Ducks Unlimited, 12 years, first for Ducks Unlimited, then with the Nature Conservancy. Both organizations were heavily involved in both the legislative discussion around the Legacy Amendment as well as the ballot initiative, along with Mr. Rice. And, in fact, Peggy Ladner, who Mr. Rice did not mention, was also on that steering committee, responsible for significant fundraising to get that ballot and initiative passed. This amendment goes back to, I would assert, 1986. 1986, then-Governor Rudy Perpich created the Blue Ribbon Panel on Minnesota's Outdoors. They came up with a report called Reinvest in Minnesota, recommended that the legislature allocate $60 million per year based on the sales tax generated by outdoor activities. For 2 years, the legislature granted $16 million. It did not ever grant more. As a result of that, the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund was born in 1988 as a way to fund that. That trust fund, as you recall, was initially set up to provide 50% of the funding to the Greater Minnesota Corporation, 50% of the funding to the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. 2 years later, the legislature changed it to 40% to the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund, 60% to the general fund, and there was a huge sense of betrayal on behalf of all the constituents that worked very hard to pass that. Out of that, I would assert, was the birth of the Legacy Amendment, and that is where Senator Lasard said, you know, we got taken. We got took, and we're going to do it over again, and this time we're going to make it so constitutionally tight that it can't be tampered with and reallocated to other sources. And that is what the advocacy groups sold to the citizens of the state of Minnesota after we convinced the legislature to put it on the ballot, and that was a tough go of it. And Senator Cohen, Senator Pogemiller were key at getting that through. Representative Anderson Kelleher was key to getting that through. I sat in her room with four other people advocating for the Lasard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council, which at the time the House was not going to hear. She consented. It got added to that, and the bill was passed, and that's ultimately was put on the ballot. The language on the ballot, the statutory framework around the Lasard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council were voted on by the voters of Minnesota. At that time, I was not heavily involved with the parks discussion, but my understanding was that the three elements of parks, Metro, DNR, Outstate, had a handshake agreement. I found out when I got in this position that there was no such thing as a handshake agreement, and that's why we have had this discussion, this debate over the past few years, and that's why, again, you tasked me with coming up with this recommendation, which we've provided. But I think the important thing is this is a pot of money for which there is much more need than there is money available. If we don't follow the frameworks that we have set in place, both by virtue of the Lasard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council, by virtue of the Minnesota Arts Board, by virtue of the Clean Water Council, and by virtue of this sort of a framework, it will continue to be a bloodbath. And I don't believe, Madam Chair, that will result in the best projects possible. I don't want to pick on particular projects, but we have control of weeds in here. We have control of zebra mussels in here. We have control of erosion in here. Madam Chair, I don't believe any of those are appropriate for legacy funding. No. And Madam Chair, with that, I stand for questions.
Okay. Well, one thing, I guess, I think one of the things I'd like to comment on is I think because of the problem with the percentages and the problem with the exactness of percentages and the fact that we seem to be going the 40 seemed to take us down, take the metro area down from what it had historically gotten in the other bills. But the that's why the House at least decided to go on a project basis instead of a percentage basis, and then kind of figure out how they came close to the percentages. It's also why we did, and I think the Senate ended up putting something similar to it in their bill, go with a council that could work out on the greater regional park, greater Minnesota regional park area, to get some kind of order into that procedure. But I think the one thing I do want to take you up on is that two of the DNR projects that were asking for legacy funds, one was for RV dumping grounds and one was for toilets in a park. So I don't understand what, you know, maybe you should have looked at those projects before they were submitted.
Madam Chair, if I could speak to that, we don't do dumping grounds. We do facilities. For camping. And, you know, if we are going to build a park as we are at Vermilion, not necessarily with legacy funding, we need to, you know, unfortunately deal with the back end of people as well as the front end of people. And, Madam Chair, that takes money.
Well, this is one of the things that we didn't think that we thought ought to be in the basic funds of the department, not in the kinds of legacy funds. So those are the kinds of things that we took out. I think the other thing we were also looking at balance through the state, is that when you look at the whole part of that proposal, 57% was going out state and approximately 57% out state and 43% to the metro area, and that didn't seem too much of an unbalance for us. I mean, we had a little problem with going to those, you know, looking at the 40-40-20 as an approximation is fine. Looking at it as a rigid rule seemed.
Again, Madam Chair, I think so. You can pick any number and justify it. I think what we've got here is a number, a formula that was given a considerable discussion by all of the parties, representatives of parties, and that's what they came up with.
When I think of a legacy, I think of the best possible projects, and to me, you know, just kind of an arbitrary number. I mean, I realize that there's a methodology that got to that number and stuff, but the fact is it's just a hard number. You know, even if there's a project that's better above that number, it's not, you know, if you stick to that number, you know, it's kind of out of luck. I just don't, you know, I think there's some wisdom in the House position here.
Senator Cohen?
Well, Madam Chair and Commissioner, relative to, Representative Cohen, what you said at the outset, that I learned everything from you that I could possibly know. And one of the things I learned from the outset was not specifying projects in bills. So, Commissioner, I'd ask Mr. Sullivan this, but so it's not meant to be a set up question, but I assume in terms of the specificity of proposals and projects, that's something you would prefer not to do, I'm guessing.
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, frankly, flexibility is very important, because we know how some of these projects can get started, stop, another priority comes up, so we do prefer having the flexibility to move money around and not necessarily have the priorities dictated in language.
Well, we specifically did follow first of all, we took the priorities specifically from the list that we were given, so we didn't invent them ourselves. And we specifically, upon the request, at one point, the section for DNR in our bill was written with specific numbers assigned to each project. And we instantly, as soon as requested, removed those specific numbers and let the project on. And, of course, one of the things we do is we do meet in annual sessions. So there's always the ability to add, subtract, and so forth, and to leave things in. We know that in some of the trails, we know that there are some that are on a to be done immediately list and to be done in the future list. So we think there's a lot of flexibility in the list that we have.
Well, Senator Cohen. Madam Chair, Commissioner, if I can follow up on that. The chair makes a good point in terms of annual sessions. relative to your need for flexibility? Do things happen within a 12-month period where, hypothetically, one trail was thought to have been ready to go ahead and it turns out not to be? How quickly do you turn around?
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, just by way of example, a winter like this precludes us starting groundwork in northern Minnesota on projects that, had we started in April, when we typically would have, we'd been able to complete. Now that that hasn't happened, do we start that project or do we look at something that could have started later in the season? So having the flexibility within the appropriation really does allow us to address the conditions that the environment presents as well as the opportunities that the projects present. And one further note on that, sometimes things pop up that we just don't anticipate. And, you know, if we're in a biennial appropriation, you know, we can have an opportunity to pop up and disappear in 6 months' time, especially with respect to an acquisition.
Representative Freiberg?
Sure. I apologize if I misunderstood you. Did you say you think it's inappropriate to use legacy funding for zebra mussel control?
For Madam Chair, members of the committee, for some of the activities that are proposed, I believe that is an incorrect. It's a personal belief that is an incorrect expenditure.
The constitutional language is, you know, speaks to habitat for fish, game, and wild, you know, for fish. I mean, I don't know.
Protect, enhance, restore habitat for fish, game, and wildlife.
That seems pretty appropriate. But.
Well, we certainly had a very large interest in putting more, in the House at least, in putting more money into aquatic invasive species.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you could spend the entire $300 million a year and not significantly move the needle.
Well, Senator Cohen and Senator.
To follow up on Representative Freiberg's question then, Commissioner, is it a question of there's simply not the resources to deal with the aquatic invasive issue in the context of the legacy monies, or is it something that's inappropriate even if we had all the money?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, it's a function of two things, I would say. The first off is that, for the most part, control of the spread of zebra mussels, and when I talk about aquatic invasive species, I want to focus on zebra mussels because that's what people are most interested in right now. For the most part, control of the spread of zebra mussels depends on individuals taking responsibility for their actions. And we often think that that means boaters. So we've got 800,000 registered boaters in the state. We had 5 million launches last year, 3,000 public accesses, double that counting the private accesses. We've got a huge resource base that we're trying to protect. We can't put somebody on every access checking every boat coming in and out. So we have to rely on the public responsibility to do the right thing. And so that becomes an education, an inspection, and enforcement effort. And yet we know that even if we checked every single boat in the state, two of the infestations that occurred last year occurred when somebody moved a boat lift from an infested lake to a non-infested lake. This was a lakeshore owner who brought those zebra mussels into their lake. We would never have caught that with the best boat inspection system in the world. And you all read just 3 weeks ago, we had barges move in from Wisconsin onto the St. Croix River to start working on the St. Croix Bridge that were infested with zebra mussels. Again, a boat ramp approach would not have caught that. So we rely on, and we've spent many, many, many hours talking about how to control the spread of zebra mussels. It has to come down to public education, public awareness, and some of the other things that we do, like decontamination stations, and we've got 20 of them, or mussel sniffing dogs, you know, we've got those now too, are intended to increase awareness and show people the challenges they face. But if we were to implement the type of a program, we did a consultant analysis several years ago to look at what the expense would be for various types of control programs, including having somebody at the primary accesses for some period of time. We could spend $500 million a year, up to $500 million a year, according to that study, just to inspect boats. So the point is that we have thought long and hard about what is the best, most cost-effective approach for Minnesota to deal with zebra mussels, and it relies on educating the public. And my concern with this is that this is responding on a request-by-request basis, and it is not a comprehensive program. It creates a winners and losers that pretty soon every lake association in the state is going to be coming to you saying, say, we want what Minnehaha Creek has got because we've got zebra mussel concerns as well. Huh. And it will just absolutely gobble up in a program that I don't believe will ultimately be workable or move the needle.
Okay. Senator Sasso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Landwehr, we've got a number of pots of money for AIS. It's like you see. Well, tell me something like this then. If you pull back, and as you said, it's public education is important. What about what we're doing over at the University of Minnesota, that type of thing?
Absolutely, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Everything that the Department of Natural Resources has is something that can slow the spread, whether we're talking about Asian carp or we're talking about zebra mussels. We will slow the spread, but that's the best. And it's sort of like, you know, holding the tide back with your hands. The only long-term solution to truly address this is through research to find ways that can, you know, be the silver bullet, if you will, for zebra mussels. And I want to give two examples. You know, I was in Duluth last week with Lieutenant Governor talking to a Great Lakes group about nuisance species. And we were there talking about spiny water fleas and zebra mussels and quagga mussels and everything else. But had we been there 30 years earlier, we'd have been talking about the lamprey. The lamprey decimated the lake trout in all of the Great Lakes, and it was believed that we would never see the lake trout again. But through research and development of new techniques, we were able to control the lamprey. The second example I would give would be purple loosestrife, and those of you that live on the West Metro know that when you would come in on Highway 5 or Highway 7 from the west, you would look at the cattail sloughs, and they would be seas of purple. If you drive by those same wetlands right now, there is no purple. Because we learned, and Luke Skinner, who was in charge of that project, he's in here today, we learned to identify biological controls to control the purple loosestrife plant. And so we have taken that research and we've applied that. We've reduced that invasive species to a much more manageable level. I think we can do the same thing for both zebra mussels and Asian carp if we invest the money in the research. And you all did that. Last year with the initiation of the Aquatic Invasive Species Research Institute at the University of Minnesota under Dr. Peter Sorensen. He's doing some great work now, and we need to continue that work.
Paul, I've got a little different
Senator
question,
yeah.
And I'm sorry if you already, because I was at a little meeting, and it was on the TV, so I followed some of this. But you talked about a feeding frenzy going on in terms of the Sard Sams or any of the funding for that matter. I was, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot here, what I'm really looking for is ideas, is potential ideas for the Metro in terms of the Sard Sams. Do you see there's a, obviously there's a different, something different here, but do you see some real potential for, we talked about it with Mr. Rice, that the flyway, there's no question about the rivers are, have great potential. Comment on that, will you, please?
Madam Chair, Senator Saxog, members of the committee, a few things around that. First off, again, I would remind us that the Metro natural resources are not just a function of the Met Council and the counties or the cities. They are a function of the Department of Natural Resources as well. And so when we submit projects to the Outdoor Heritage Fund, or from the Outdoor Heritage Fund to the Outdoor Heritage Council, Metro projects are in that mix as well. And some of them have gotten funded. It's not as if they aren't getting funded. I think the challenge with that funding cycle, of course, is that the state is very big. And there are a lot of needs across the state. And I believe that the council does a great job of saying, okay, well, yes, this is a good Metro project, and this is a good outstate project, and here's the cost benefit. And when they look at it from the standpoint of the state as a whole, I think they have generally landed on the right project. So I think what I'm suggesting is I don't know that it is broken. If what the issue is that you believe there's a need to get more money into the Metro area, then I would suggest that you can't evaluate necessarily Metro projects with the same metrics that you use for outstate projects. And Madam Chair, members of the committee, there is a small grant program as well that I want to mention. It's the Conservation Partners Legacy Grant Program. It's a block grant to the Department of Natural Resources that we then do a RFP for and solicit projects under $400,000. We are looking at working with the council on that specifically to develop criteria for a subset of that that could deal with metro issues that might not otherwise have fared well, either because they're small or because they don't compare and contrast well with outstate projects. You know, when you look at the outstate projects that are getting done, as well as the metro projects, they are phenomenal. Recall we spent $35 million on the UPM land and easement. That is 188,000 acres that will be there in perpetuity, publicly protected, publicly accessible. Spent $11 million last year on the Northwoods project by Brainerd. Amazing project that will be there forever. So these are very good projects that are being done, and we shouldn't lose sight of that fact.
I think the Northwoods project by Brainerd was one of the frustrations because that was clearly a park in an urban area and so forth, and it didn't seem to be that different from the Metropolitan Council park areas, just only its location.
And Madam Chair, if I could just offer one notion on that as well. If there's an example of where a metro area is getting funds, it might not be this metro area, but it is that metro area, and we have to be conscious that there's not just one metro area in the state.
What we were saying, I think the only difference was the geographical location within the state. But there's one point I think that Representative Freiberg made that we've been trying to make in our conversations. I don't know if we've done it as well as we can in our allocations, that what we're most interested in is 20 years from now seeing a real legacy in the state, and we're most interested in things that connect. You know, I said the ideal project, as I would see, would be a trail along a waterway with something to control pollution into the waterway that connected a state park with a metro park and also had some art through a historic district. And anything that we could do like that ought to be just... But the idea of kind of taking... seeing parts of the state and seeing a real change that we could possibly make. But the also, in talking about the AIS, one of the things that we've thought is this idea that there are areas that will have different ideas of things to do. You know, a watershed district that may have a different, more intensive supervision and control and so forth. And so putting that money out in the two places that we've done just seems like a really good proposal. There's another proposal that's in that the House put in. It's Lasard Sam's proposal that the Malpas project in northeastern Minnesota, isn't that pretty similar to the Blandin one? And what's your opinion on how fast we can do that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for bringing that up. One thing I want to point out is that the House bill also appropriates money for a second year that was not ever run by the department. So, could we spend it? Probably. Is it something that I can give you priorities for today? No. I have been in discussion with the Malpas folks. They have, give or take, 250,000 acres that is not under easement. They've got something like 160,000 acres that is under easement already that was obtained from the Forest Capital Partners Corporation prior to that. Malpas, at this point in time, is not interested in easement. Their primary concern is their tax impacts that is a result of either the classification of the lands or the loss of the SFIA payment. And I met with their vice president 3 weeks ago. He said, I'm not even going to talk about a conservation easement until we deal with the tax stuff. So at this point in time, they are not ready to sit down and talk about an easement. The day that we sit down and start talking about what a project might look like. We talk about the lands that they've got because they're scattered all over. We talk about what the state might be interested in. Not all of their lands have the same level of interest. It will take 18 months from that day to the day we close. So, again, the annual cycle of the Lasard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council gives us the flexibility to know how much we need and request that from the council in a proper time frame.
Well, the... direction we were going to was at least putting a chunk of money out. You know, obviously money isn't spent until it can be done. And the nice thing about Lasard Sam's or about any of the legacy stuff is that it just goes to the bottom of the legacy fund if it's not spent. But we thought that it might be useful to show an interest of the state in moving forward on that. But
Madam Chair, I know they know the state is interested.
Okay. Senator
Madam Chair and Commissioner, let me ask, relative to some of this line of questioning about Lasard Council, you were present, I gave that little speech about what the voters intended or what was promised to voters relative to this, and I guess at this table I'm the second most senior legislator in terms of years in the legislature, and I've certainly been a full participant in legislative efforts that at times I also criticize. I think into this in the Finance Committee where I talked about the inability of us to keep our little paws off of everything that comes in front of us, and I've certainly been a participant in that. But let me ask about this question in terms of Lasard Council, and because you have this very interesting intersection as commissioner, the work you did prior to being commissioner relative to conservation efforts in the state, and the history of the council and the promulgation of Lasard work. What about this kind of inviolate position? And obviously, I've articulated, I think, the Senate position relative to that, but the kind of inviolate position that we need to maintain the integrity of the council, the work it's done, as opposed to, you know, is there something that the council maybe should have done that the legislature, with some deliberation, should take a second look at?
Mm-hmm.
Tell your background, too, before you...
I'm sorry.
Did you already do that?
He did that.
Oh, okay.
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, you know, I want to go back again to 2007, 2008 in the legislative discussions, and Mr. Redmond was party to some of these discussions. There was, again, there was in the Senate version, there the council was in there. It was not in the House version, and there was not any movement on behalf of the House to entertain the council in there. And we came very close to a complete meltdown because the sporting community was saying, if we don't have a council in there, we'll start lobbying against it. And I remember a very heated conversation with some of the folks and Mr. Redmond about the possibility of that happening. And that resulted in a meeting with Representative Anderson Kelleher. And there were five of us that went in there. It was Ron Scherer and myself and Dave Zentner and a couple other people, and told her that, you know, we had gotten to the 99-yard line because I'm not a football guy. We had gotten to the goal, almost to the goalpost. And it was about to go down. And the sporting community felt so strongly that if they could not assure the voters that there was a process in place to allocate funds that was beyond just sort of a legislative process like this, that they would not have – they would feel we were going right back to the lottery bill and it would be subject to the same thing. So recognizing it wasn't going to be in the constitutional language, the sporting conservation community insisted that it be in the statute, and that was, of course, in place when the vote was taken. I think that the conservation community recognizes that there may be opportunities or issues that arise that the legislature may need to do something with. And so you recall the very first year there was $2 million appropriated for Emerald Ash Borer that had not gone through the council. There was an appropriate, I believe the first Asian carp appropriation came from legislative directive. There have been times when the legislature said, yes, this is a good package, and you know what? We need to do something else. And the in fact, the if I'm not mistaken, I think the UPM Blandon easement was divided over a two-year basis based on legislative input. So the legislature has weighed in. But I think that the conservation community believes very firmly that the intention was that that this legislative citizen panel should make recommendations that they could make based on a very long and thoughtful and deliberate process that doesn't otherwise happen in the frenzy of a legislative session, and that for the most part, those are good, solid recommendations that have had substantial discussion among people representing the citizens of the state, and only in rare and good cases should those be vastly altered. And I'm giving you what my perception is based on my discussions in the community.
Well, let me just say one thing, that the House completely intact funded every one of the Lasard Sam's Outdoor Heritage recommendations. in the bill that they did not. But the Emerald Ash Borer, are you sure about that was funded in the Outdoor Heritage? Was that? I thought it was proposed and then funded elsewhere somehow. Okay. Yeah, okay.
Yes. Well, I guess this one cop. Yeah, you mentioned that, you know, it was important for the outdoors community so that they could, you know, convince the voters that, you know, there's this other body out there that makes the recommendations. And, you know, again, just going back to me as a, you know, some fairly engaged voter, but, you know, not part of the legislature, not part of those discussions. You know, when I voted for it, I don't think it was part of my thinking that there would be, you know, kind of an unelected body, you know, making these suggestions that need to be followed wholesale. I think there is a lot of good stuff in there, but I mean, if anything, the constitutional language indicates the opposite. It says the money dedicated under this section shall be appropriated by law. And we do, you know, in the House position, we do fund all of them, as Chair Kahn, all of the recommendations, as Chair Kahn pointed out. So,
and Madam Chair, members of the committee, and that is absolutely recognized. Nobody disagrees that the legislature has the ultimate authority to appropriate. When the discussions were had, there was, as to my second point, you know, what is the framework for fund allocation? There was four different groups, right? The arts and culture, the parks and trails, the outdoor heritage, and the clean water. Three of those thought they had a structure in place. The Arts Board was the entity for the arts cultural heritage money. The Clean Water Council was the entity for the clean water funding, and the Outdoor Heritage Council was believed to be the entity for the Outdoor Heritage Fund. Again, in my discussions with the Parks and Trails advocates, and I talked with them a lot, they believed that they had a handshake agreement about how those funds would be distributed and that they did not want similar language for the Parks and Trails Fund in the statute before the ballot. They thought they could work it out after the fact. And, you know, of course, that's why we're here today, because, in fact, they can't. So,
well,
I have one other question for the commissioner. I know we have other folks who want to listen to. One of the things I think I mentioned, I certainly mentioned on the Senate floor, and I think at the outset of the conference committee, is I don't suggest that unilaterally a legislature ought to give deference to a governor. And, Madam Chair, you've served with more governors than I have, but I've always been struck by kind of the psychology of this place, where the governor is somebody out there. You know, it's the commissioners, the deputy commissioners who appear in front of us. But I mentioned that in the Senate bill, there was some deference to the governor relative to the parks and trails. And there was also, my understanding from my discussion with the administration, relative to the Lessard recommendations. I mean, you're the representative of the governor in this conference committee, at this conference committee. Without asking you to betray any confidential conversations, how strongly does the governor feel? Again, I suggest that sometimes the governor is just this figure that's somewhere. I mean, obviously, governors don't appear in front of legislative committees except under very, very unusual circumstances. I think I've seen that once when Governor Perpich appeared in front of a committee. So I can't remember any other time a governor has appeared in front of any kind of a committee. So, at least that I've been on. What's the position of the governor relative to the bill generally? Or maybe more particularly what your areas of the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think it's fair to say that with respect to the Outdoor Heritage Fund, the governor feels very, very strongly. He campaigned on honoring the process and the recommendations. He has given every indication since then that he believes in the process and the projects. I think he supports the Senate position very strongly. With respect to the parks allocation, I think the governor does not come with a preconceived notion. He didn't campaign on anything, but I think he believes that the process that we used was appropriate. And as you know, the governor is one who wants people to come in and give their thoughts and then develop a consensus recommendation. That's what we did. So I think the governor supports that as well.
So Madam Chair, if I might, I'm governors don't usually issue unilateral declarations, and I have not heard Governor Dayton do so in this instance. But so what happens? I mean, does he veto the bill? A conference can report the bill in its entirety. Does he let him veto? Does he veto certain sections? What has there been any discussion? If you can indicate publicly as to what his position might be. And if not, I would understand that.
Madam Chair and Senator Cohen, that's above my pay grade.
Fair enough.
I feel very comfortable handing the governor a bill that based along the House positions and watch him line item veto the parts he doesn't like.
Well, Madam Chair, I've seen governors do that, and sometimes they do okay with that, and sometimes they don't.
Right. Well, it's part of the process. I guess it's one of the abilities we give him to. Okay, are there any other questions? Yes. Representative Frog.
Yeah, Commissioner, do you feel like the, you know, we heard that the Metro Habitat proposal was reduced to a 5-page summary. You know, I've seen the 150-page version that was mentioned. It's very specific. It talks about how each of the 15 proposals, you know, enhance wetlands, prairies, forests, or habitat for fish, game, and wildlife. I imagine if that was reduced to 5 pages, most of that information will get left off. Do you think that was a sufficient vetting of that particular proposal?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think, you know, obviously there are proposals that get submitted for much, much more money that contain many more elements. I think, you know, there's, you know, as a person who's written grant proposals in the past, you know, there's really two elements of writing grant proposals. There's A, having a project, a good project, and B, there's having a good proposal. And I would submit that perhaps some grantsmanship on writing the proposal could have elevated the ranking of the proposal. I'm speculating here. I'm not on the committee, obviously, but I think the nature of the project had some effect of that as well.
I've written grant proposals as well. I work in the nonprofit field. I mean, you know, usually you'll have an abstract, which is a lot shorter, and then the much broader proposal outlining, you know, how the proposal addresses everything in the request for proposals or whatever it may be. But, you know, in this case, I think it was very specific about how it followed the constitutional requirements, and the fact that it was reduced in such a manner led to some of the misinformation that was out there about that particular proposal.
Other questions for the commissioner? Okay. Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Okay. The next person on our list was, sorry, your name has been mentioned so much that you have to, is Bill Becker. We'll let him speak in any way that he wants to start, and then we'll
Madam
give
Chair,
him some questions.
So. Chair Cohen, members of the committee. I'm Bill Becker. I'm the executive director of the Lisard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council, and I was not at the table or in this Chair Cohen's office when this was put together. I've worked for 35 years for the state of Minnesota, primarily for the Department of Natural Resources. I'm here as the executive director of the Lisard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. I am your employee. I'm an employee of the House. I'm an employee of the Senate. I'm a nonpartisan employee. Anytime you want to know about Lisard Sams and what we're up to and what we're trying to do, please come to 95 State Office Building, ground level. I want to say that situation puts me in an interesting position here today, and I'm going to do my best to give you the process and procedure and the straight-up information on what I know about what has transpired. I want to say right off the bat that the council position is the Senate position. The council prefers the Senate position. I want to talk to you about the council process. I want to talk to you about Metro Parks in particular. And I want to talk to you about David Hartwell's concerns. Mr. Hartwell is the chair of the council. He's in Washington, D.C., lobbying. Among the things he's working on is closure of the St. Anthony Lock, and has had some success, I might add. So with that, let's talk just a little bit about what the council is trying to do with its process. And the council's job is to recommend strategic investments in habitat that benefit wildlife, focuses on wildlife populations in the state of Minnesota. It's investments in the habitat that supports them. Quickly, what we try to do is create a level playing field for the people of Minnesota who might want to do it. It's an open playing field. Anyone can apply. We're taking applications right now for FY15 expenditures. And in 2014, here is the request for proposals that we distributed. If I could have you pass those down. I think the important thing I'd like to point out to you is that everybody has the same instructions. Everybody has the same form with the same questions, which is accessible through an online application form found at Lasard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council site. And I want to take you to page, the third page in, that has statewide priority criteria, and then take you to the following page 4 that has the vision and priorities for each of the ecological sections of Minnesota. And lastly, I want to take you quickly to page 7, which is the metro urbanizing vision, and point out that what we're trying to do in the metropolitan urbanizing area is enhance and restore remnant native prairie, bigwoods, forests, oaks. And I wanted to especially point out to protect habitat corridors with emphasis on the Minnesota, Mississippi, St. Croix rivers. We want to enhance and restore cold water fishery systems and protect and enhance riparian and littoral habitats on lakes that benefit game and non-game fish. You've heard testimony on what the Met Council proposal did. I think that that is in keeping with what we were looking for the area. We're following the state's general grant management procedures. The proposals are received. They're put into a binder for each one, for each recipient or each member of the council, and they're provided, the members of the council are provided with a sheet to score each proposal on. And I'm going to give you a copy of that sheet just so you can see what the criteria are that we use. Specifically, those statewide criteria that were mentioned earlier are excuse me while I fumble with these papers here. Statewide criteria are on, at the top, and each proposal is scored against its clear, whether or not it's clear, effective, and directly addresses the problems outlined, whether it's an urgent problem, whether it'll effectively address Minnesota's pertinent conservation plans, which is a requirement, whether it's grounded in conservation science, whether the request is effective, whether it effectively addresses relevant LSOHC section priorities, which we just looked at, whether it maximizes leverage with other funding sources, whether the budget supplements the organization's traditional funding sources, the level of funding is reasonable for each component of the budget, whether the request has a well-designed plan for sustainability and maintenance, and whether the stated outcomes provide meaningful evaluative data. After filling out these forms, these are sent into the LSOHC offices. They've been individually filled out by members, and we calculate a score for each proposal. The score is the average that the proposal received. Here's the summary of the scores for the round of applications. that we're talking about today. And the important thing about this is that there were 39 proposals reviewed. What the council did was took a look at the average score and the difference between average scores and went down the list of proposals until they got to a place where there was a large break. And this is a standard way of trying to triage your work. And you can see on number 33, green corridors, there was a 4.1 differential. And then there were a series of proposals below that that didn't score as well. We've talked a lot about the submission and what it contained. And I brought with me copies just so you all would have them to see what was provided and what the council members had to look at. And I know some of you have seen this, but maybe not all of you had. See if those will go. What you have before you is the Met Council proposal. It's a complex proposal. It had 16 projects in it. It was described in 5 pages using the standard questions. I wanted you to look at another proposal, one that was funded, that used the same system, is in the same area. And looks a little bit different. And that's Metro Big Rivers. And I'd like to take you through that because it can demonstrate how you can use your space effectively. And if you look at page 2, there's a discussion of each individual partner and what they're going to do. If you look at page 5, there's a discussion of sustainability and maintenance, acceleration of current efforts. You look at page 6, the projects are briefly described and their due date or completion date is laid out. There are budgets for the project as a whole and budgets for each individual item. And there are descriptions of the projects in terms of their acreage, where they are in the town range, direction and section. Whether hunting and fishing is allowed, and the estimated cost. So it's possible to use the approach the council uses to fairly and clearly describe what you're doing. It's designed to provide the information that allows the members of the council to do the basic initial scoring so that they can call projects in for hearing and get more in-depth information. It's a situation of trying to allocate effort effectively. The next step in the proposal is a hearing. The hearings are held. The council members then are required to allocate funds in a meeting, and the recommendations come to the speaker and to the majority leader. That's the process. It's a standard process. It's a fair process. Everybody fills the same thing out and has the same information. We worked with the metro area, the Metro Met Council. There's been a lot of discussion about that. I've prepared a timeline from the staff records that indicates what the involvement was. You can see here that we started early on 14th of May working with Met Council. That was barely after session was over. And we worked with them all the way through August or July 9th of 2012. I think that the important, it's all important, but the most important finding of this is that we had a problem attaching an 8-megabyte file. We didn't realize it was coming. We got started late in doing it. We couldn't attach it. I think that it's also important that the if you look at the 6th and the 9th of July, that we contacted the Met Council, and that they indicated that we had agreed to handle the handout of the 127-page attachment in the hearing. So what happened was there was not enough effort put into the initial application. There was a lot of effort put into the description. It's unfortunate. It's a lack of communication, but there was nothing nefarious intended. We all did our best, and that's where we're at today. So that brings me to the position that the council has relative to the proposals. As I said earlier, we favor the Senate proposal. Specifically, we are concerned about the Met Council proposal in its cost. It is as much as $15,000 an acre for restoration and enhancement. You can compare that to outstate Board of Water and Soil Resources or DNR enhancement of their properties at $300 and an acre. We are concerned about the aquatic invasives. They are, as we've discussed a minute ago, a difficult thing to deal with. Specifically, the ability to stop them on the various vectors they have is nigh upon impossible. In fact, I would like to say that we've had testimony from Peter Sorensen that they're even transmitted, the villagers are even transmitted by waterfowl. We are slowing them, but what the council is looking for and what's in the request for proposals before you is anything that permanently or in the long term will protect our waters from those creatures, critters, more organisms. You have in your packet a letter from David Hartwell. Very quickly, he talks about the Met Council project, and his concern there is its cost effectiveness, urgency, significance, and statewide habitat plans. In addition, he points out that there's a significant amount of funding in the package, and there has been historically, $41 million. We've heard that before. The packet before you has projects in the Vermilion Linear Park, Trillium Nature Sanctuary, Cottage Grove Ravine Regional Park, in Martin's Meadow Open Space. He talks a little bit about aquatic invasive species and is concerned especially about the tails that may be created by an investment today in something that is at best a partial solution or slowing things down. He's also concerned about the annual versus biannual and the flexibility issue. I would say that annual allocations and recommendations enabled the council to come up with $5.5 million late in the game to put together structural deterrents to invasive carp. And I just want to mention very quickly that these are invasive creatures. Invasive means they're difficult, if not nigh upon impossible, to stop. And finally, he's concerned that in the House version of the appropriation, there are appropriations that are never reviewed by the council, and he was not clear how the proposals were solicited, reviewed, what the criteria was for selection, the vetting of them, and things of that sort. This is especially true with the money that's being spent in the second year. He points out the Office of the Legislative Auditor stated that the Lasard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council provides a layer of oversight and accountability for the Outdoor Heritage Fund that's not in present for other funds, and in that he closes. I guess the summary of what I have to say is that we understand, we make recommendations. We understand clearly who appropriates. We try to use science and a fair process to provide you with the best recommendations we can, and we've done that. With that, I'll stand for questions and thank the indulgence of the committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Becker, for a very thorough explanation. But I do think at some point then the issue was brought up that this Metro Habitat project had things behind it which was not recognized by the Lasard-Sams Council. So this is, in a sense, the legislature putting its opinions on top of that. There are two, plus the fact that, you know, a legislature is a political body, and when you have a bill that's been introduced to fund that, funded by authored, this is only something that happens in the House because the Senate has different processes, bill that had 35 totally bipartisan authors, it's something that's certainly needs to be looked at. I have a lot of problems with the idea of talking about cost effectiveness, because anything you try and do in the metropolitan area is going to be less cost effective than something that you do in another part of the state. It's also accessible, though, to very, very, very many more people. So, you know, with the cost effectiveness, I think you have who's paying the price for this, where are the taxes being collected for it, and who's going to be able to benefit from it in terms of easy access. So, you know, the recognition that land and probably labor costs in the metro area are always going to be higher is something that I think maybe got us to the fact that the Lasard-Sams Council over the years has funded about 10% of its total budget has gone into the metro area. So, you know, I think all that's been recognized, but I think to ask for an additional amount, which amounts to about 1% of the entire legacy budget, is not, or if you want to look at it, 7 or 8% of the Lasard-Sams part of it, I don't think is an off-the-wall request from the metropolitan area, particularly when we've had a certain amount of testimony as to why we think that that didn't get adequate. I don't care whose fault it was, didn't get adequate discussion by the council. The thing that, which in the data didn't come forward, that interested me was when I looked at the individual recommendations on that sheet, you had total extremes. You know, you had people who ranked it very, very highly and then people who ranked it very, very lowly. And as someone who's, before I got into this complex part of the legislature, was used to doing scientific research, I would always look at something like that with a certain amount of skepticism.
Madam Chair, I worked my way through college and master's degree running statistics for PhD students. I agree with you in your position with regard to the variance. I want you to know that the variance is at this table, that the high score and the low score is sitting at this table. So you can deal with it.
Oh, so you think we should go right in the middle?
I just wanted you to know, Madam Chair. The economics argument is a relevant argument. The council, it's my observation, is not so anthropocentric, not as concerned about the human aspects of things as they are the wildlife aspects. And that's different from the legislature, and I think it's a good thing for the fund to have people of that sort talking about how to spend the wildlife fund. I think that's...
I mean, it's a good thing to have those anthropomorphic people look at it.
Century.
Second.
Century.
Madam Chair, just for the record, I've been here for quite a while. It's the first time I've heard a witness ever use the phrase anthropocentric. So,
Madam Chair, Chair Cohen, I've been dying to use it here.
What did he say?
He's been dying to use it.
Oh, saving it.
So okay. I think we do our best to give you the best advice we can. And we understand there may be changes. We think that it is an extended process and not a sudden process, and that dialogue and interchange between the legislature and the council is good. We think it's important that the legislative representatives on the council help carry the message that you all have here back to the citizen members and get a reasoned step forward. That's what I can say about that.
Let me ask one other question, which is the issue between the annual and the biennial budget. One of the things that's frustrated me ever since 100 years ago when I was chairing LCMR in those days is the fact that we get something which is totally set, you know, in the summer or in some early time, and then we come to the legislature and we don't pass it until the end of May. And the whole concept, it's bad enough in a biennial budget when you miss one. So you kind of, by the time the money gets out and by the time people get to do it, you've kind of missed one whole, maybe not this year, but other years you've missed one whole field season. And it's bad enough on a biennial budget where that only happens once. In an annual budget, it happens every year you do it.
Madam Chair, personally, for the staff's sake, I would prefer a biennial budget. It's easier. For the sake of wildlife and for the sake of the programs, annual works really well. We recommend appropriations that last 3 years for restoration and 5 years for acquisition, I think is the way it is. I got it back. 5 years for restoration and 3 years for acquisition. In recognition of the fact that it takes 5 years to restore something, we put that money out every year. What I like about annual as an administrative employee is that we get to take a look at the progress that each program is making each year and make a judgment about whether or not they're effectively spending the money or need more money, that sort of thing. That's important. The other thing that is good about annual in regard to acquisitions is that having the money up front in the year is important because of issues regarding tax consequences. If you're in the land purchasing business, December is your month to close, not because it's the holiday season or anything like that. December is the month to close because it freezes your tax situation. So from an administrative point of view, a pragmatic point of view, a program point of view, we prefer annual. I haven't heard any recipients say anything different. So that's the position we take.
Representative
Frager. In the case of the Metro Habitat proposal, was that treated as you know, as far as the council members were concerned, as one proposal or as 15 separate proposals, projects?
After brief discussions with public officials who were interested in seeing this proposal come forward, staff worked with Met Council and decided along with them that it was best to put together a package of proposals. What we do for the sake of efficiency is we find the programs that we want to invest in that produce those outcomes that we want to have around 20, 25 years from now and invest in them year after year after year in the hopes of having this tangible, durable outcome in the end. That pushed us toward talking about a package of individual proposals that could be in the next fiscal year or the next biennium reloaded. You'll notice in our recommendations we have phase three, phase four, phase five. Those are those programs we found that do what we think needs to be done. So they were treated as a package. I think that's what I can say.
Yes.
Madam Chair, I was one of those that Mr. Becker mentioned. I believe I gave it a 90 or something, and so you must have been on the other end or something. So,
I don't know. I don't know what my secret number is.
But in fairness, it was an interesting process, and I just think the people have to realize it's a little complicated. It's a lot like bonding. You know, we're just talking about the bonding bill upstairs, and Alice, Chair Hausman, there's far more proposals that ever.
I apologize, Representative Lee. Madam Chair, we have one last bill that I want to vote on special orders. I think this is it. Can you give Sir Sasso and myself 5 minutes?
Sure.
Is that okay?
Of course.
Yeah.
Promise no more than 5 minutes.
And then I think after that we'll adjourn.
Yeah, I apologize
recess.
For getting close to that.
Recess. Thank you.
I'll be right back.
I was one of the leaders in the Dakota Colony and the Arboretum.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Okay. We'll recess until the senators return.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
It's affected by so as we progress in session,
It's
frustrating.
No, it's worse
when we only make a recommendation that's accepted.
So
I was absolutely right on that. Emerald Ashbora. The Lasard, the council didn't recommend it, and Greg Davids put it in on the floor of the House out of Lasard Sands, but it was just added. What?
I wasn't sure.
What? I just checked. Yeah. No, I knew that there was something that, so he kind of answered it.
I just didn't think that there's anything you're particularly interested in.
No, I couldn't.
Yeah. And give us, tell the lobbyists to give us like a 10-minute head start of getting something to 123 before they move. Well, whenever we start moving stuff.
So they ask all this.
Some of you asked in this room.
Okay. Every one of these.
He sounded like, oh no, they're wrong. It was in the family.
You're calling.
So it's.
I think he could have answered that a little more. I didn't ask the question.
I know, it was the fancy lawsuit thing.
Was it recommended?
I don't know. I think I've called it. Maybe I'm just.
Oh,
Oh my gosh, you're fast. You're like a ninja. You went and voted? You're that fast?
Yeah, but your colleague hasn't come back. Can we say one senator is enough to...
I just ran up the stairs. And
that's good.
Yeah.
I'd kind of like to finish my thought if I can.
Fill us in. So I read the Trib article last night after I saw you.
Oh, the voting?
Oh, the voting one? Yeah, you guys... They're a lot purer than we are.
It's really strange.
We're voting right now.
When I was in the House, I thought, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And then I got to the Senate, I thought, yeah, that's really not the way to do things.
Well, we
like food on the floor.
I don't know how